person?
I'm afraid I never did remember my question.
Okay. How did the tutorial go?
Rather well. Aside from that, I tried to apply the long definition of cycle folder.
Right.
Okay,
good. Any other questions on quantum cryptography or anything else? Okay, then maybe let's get started with today's lecture, which is going to be about quantum error correction. So the context of quantum error correction is we have Alice, we have Bob, and Alice wants to communicate to Bob. And in particular, she wants to communicate across a quantum channel. She wants to send quantum states. And this quantum channel, unfortunately, doesn't work perfectly. Okay? So instead of just taking whatever qubits Alice puts in and spitting them out on Bob's side, it performs some quantum operation. A CPTP map is the most general thing it can do, right? And so what Bob gets has been changed in some way from what Alice sent. And so the idea of quantum error correction is to see if there's some sort of encoding that Alice can do so that Bob can recover from the actions of this completely positive phrase-preserving map, this quantum channel, and get back the original state that Alice wanted to send. Okay? So, of course, if Alice doesn't know anything at all about what this quantum channel does, and Bob doesn't know, well, there's not very much they can do, right? Particularly if it really could be anything, right? Because then, effectively, whatever state she puts in gets totally randomized, and there's no information left that you can work with. But in general, that won't be the case. Alice will and Bob will have some idea of what this quantum operation is. And in particular, it might act in some limited way. So for instance, it might just cause an error on each qubit independently with some probability. Now, there are certain things that are very easy to correct for. So for instance, if Alice knows that there's a unitary rotation, and she knows what that unitary is, and Bob knows that too, then Alice doesn't need to do any encoding. She can just send it through the channel. And then when Bob receives it, he can undo the unitary. Okay? But in general, quantum channels are going to have noise that is not unitary. And so Alice and Bob will need some way to kind of remove entropy that gets introduced when the error of the quantum channel acts on it. OK. So to do quantum error correction, it makes sense to, of course, look at the analogous classical situation. Oh, I should say, so I'm putting this in the context of communication, where Alice, you know, is one place and Bob is somewhere else. She wants to send qubits to him. But it doesn't have to be that. The same thing can work if you just want to store a qubit. And then Alice is kind of the past and Bob is the future. And so Alice and Bob could really be the same person, right? You store your qubit and then you go away, and maybe there's some noise that happens while it's stored. And you come back at some time later, and you want to correct for that noise and get back the thing you stored. Okay. And of course, it could be, you know, the memory of a quantum computer. And so ultimately, you'd want to put on top of this something that allows you to do computations that are protected against errors. I'll talk about that probably a little bit tomorrow. OK, so classical error correction. So what's classical error correction like? Well, you'll work through some of the more elaborate formalism in the tutorial today. But or actually, most of it is in expository text at the start of the tutorial. But here's a very simple classical error correcting code called the repetition code. Classical code. So what does that do? Well, that kind of does the most obvious thing. You want to send a bit, and so it encodes each bit as three copies of itself. So 0 gets sent to 000, and 1 gets sent to 111. Okay? And imagine we're in the situation where I mentioned before, where each bit has an error with independently with a certain probability. So classically, an error on a bit is a bit flip. So each bit gets flipped with probability p. And so if this is independent from bit to bit, then the probability of one error is actually equal to 3 times p. The probability of two errors well, that's 3 times p squared. Sorry, this is not right. So exactly one error is p times 1 minus p squared. And two errors is 3p squared times 1 minus p. And then there's a possibility of three errors, of course, which is p cubed. Okay, so where do I get this factor of 3? Well, there's three places this error could occur, right? So if the error rate is relatively high, so say the error rate is above about a third, then the probability of having two errors, sorry, the probability of having one error by encoding in three bits rather than one bit, the probability of one error has increased, right? Because here you have just probability p of having an error, and here you have this quantity. And in fact, in general, the probability of having one error is going to increase. This is always going to be bigger than p. But the point is that the probability of having two errors when p is small is substantially lower than the probability of having one error. And if there's only one error, then the fact that we have these three bits encoding lets us recover from it, right? Because if we see something like 0, 1, 0, we say, oh, well, that was probably just one bit being flipped, because errors are unlikely, and one error is substantially more likely than two errors, okay? Or zero errors, for that matter, is likely too. So, well, zero errors is 1 minus p cubed. And so you say this we're going to correct to 0, 0, 0. OK? So the point is that by encoding, so if we don't encode, we have to look at the probability of zero error versus one error, and that's p. And then when we do encode, we can look at the probability of zero or one error versus two or three errors. Okay, and so that means that by encoding the probability, so if there's actually two errors here, of course, we'll be wrong, right? And this actually came from here, because it would have been the first and third bits that got flipped in that case. So by encoding, we trade off the error rate, the effective error rate, or logical error rate, goes from the probability of p to something of order p squared, right? Because this is without encoding, and with encoding, it has to be two or three errors to cause a problem. Sorry, I stumbled over that explanation a little bit, but I hope it came through clear enough in the end. Yes? OK. So normally, actually, we simplify when we're talking about error correction. And we'll just assume that there is 0 or 1 error in this particular context. Assume 0 or 1 error and ignore the possibility of two errors. Okay, but the reason we want to do this is basically because of this type of argument that well, really what happens then is we're not eliminating the possibility of error by correcting one error, but we're reducing it from order p to order p squared. Okay, and similarly, if you want to have an error correcting code that corrects more errors, so for a code that corrects t errors, then, well, we ignore the possibility of t plus 1 or more errors, and we just try to correct all errors affecting up to t bits. And doing that, then the logical error probability will become order p to the t plus 1, right? Because the probability of having t plus 1 errors is p to the t plus 1 times, you know, some constant times 1 minus p to the something, OK? And again, when p is small, this is quite substantially smaller than the probability, than the unencoded probability of error. OK? So classical error correction, all done. So now let's go to quantum error correction. OK? So quantum error correction, you might say, well, let's do the same thing. We'll encode a cube, we'll take a qubit, and we'll encode it as three copies of itself. Right? That's the obvious analog of this repetition code. So what's wrong with that? Can't make copies. Is that what you're going to say?
No.
OK, well, what were you going to say then?
There's a lot more degrees of freedom.
There's a lot more degrees of freedom. Also true. So two problems already with this plan. So first of all, the no cloning theorem says you can't make copies. Second of all, there's a lot more degrees of freedom both to encode and also a lot more freedom as to what kinds of errors can occur. Yeah?
I mean, the no cloning theorem only applies to kind of unknown states. So, you know.
Well, that's true. But suppose we have an unknown quantum state,
then
we want to protect it, right? That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I mean, in particular, if you know, we have a big quantum computation, and we're kind of halfway done with it, well, we don't really know what that quantum state is going to be. And in fact, it's not really even well defined as a pure state, because it's probably going to be entangled with some other part of the quantum computer. So these seem like two problems.
If we wanted to do like a repetition judge for quantum system, one thing is it possible in general just to like if you want to make the most naive possible system, couldn't you like just have three computers and run the calculation on each of them and then do the error correction?
Sure, you could do that. The problem is that it wouldn't actually work. I mean, it would work in the sense that if one of them gets to the end of the computation and gives you the right answer, great. But the problem is if you're doing a really long computation, well, the probability of error at each point will build up, right? And so the probability of not having an error in the first step is 1 minus p, and the probability of not having an error in the second step is, again, 1 minus p. And so if you go through n steps, the probability of getting to the n is 1 minus p to the n without getting through the whole computation. And so the number of, if you do a computation of a long computation of n steps, you have to do exponentially many times before you can get through without having any errors. Okay, so that's what we want to avoid. With error correcting codes, we can stop at intermediate times and correct it, where we wouldn't be able to do that really with just repeating the computation independently. Okay, so barriers to quantum error correction. Seems like there's some problems. QECC. It's quantum error correcting codes. QECC. So first of all, we have the no cloning theorem. Prohibits repetition. And it seems like this is an important part of error correction, right? Because we have to add some redundancy here so that if there's an error, we can still recover the original state. We don't lose the information. Okay, so let me mention another problem, which you might see if you stare at this example a little longer, which is that, well, how do we figure out how to correct the state? Well, we have to look at it to see where the error is. But if it's a quantum state, then looking at it could collapse it, right? We want to protect superpositions. We don't want to collapse those superpositions. So how do we measure without collapsing the state? Okay. And then, let's be consistent. Then there's this question of extra degrees of freedom, right? So we have to protect not just against bit flips, but also against the phase flips, right? Because the state alpha 0 plus beta 1 is different from the state alpha 0 minus beta 1. And that kind of error could occur, and we need to be able to deal with it. So we need to correct both bit flips and also phase flips. But of course, this is not the most general type of thing that could occur to a quantum state. Even if we just restrict attention to restrict our attention to errors that occur in a single qubit, right? There's a lot more things that could go wrong, right? We could have a general completely positive map. We could have, you know, complete dephasing where we lose the phase of that qubit altogether. We could have, you know, continuous rotations, right? Change the phase of the gate by some arbitrary angle e to the I theta, depending on whether it's 0 or 1, right? This R theta gate. And decoherence, et cetera. So somehow we have to be able to take all of these types of errors into account and still get a good quantum error correcting code. Okay, so this is pretty daunting. Obviously, there's got to be some way to solve this thing, or I wouldn't be standing here talking about quantum error correction. And actually, probably I wouldn't be standing here talking about quantum computers at all, because if you couldn't do if there were no way to solve these problems, quantum computers would probably not be plausibly something you could build. But there are, of course, solutions. But let's start at the beginning. So first, let's think about this no-cloning theorem. Okay. So we have this classical repetition code, and it could be possible to at least make some quantum version of that, right? I said that any classical reversible computation we can convert into a quantum computation. We should, you know, be able to similarly convert any classical error correcting code into something that's stored in qubits. So what if we did that, right? So what if we just take the repetition code and put kets around it? So 0 goes to 0, 0, 0. 1 goes to 1, 1, 1. At least this should work for protecting classical bits. What happens if we encode a quantum bit in this code? Well, by linearity, we know that alpha 0 plus beta 1 has to go to alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. Okay? And this, you see, doesn't violate the no-cloning theorem. Why not? This is not three copies of alpha 0 plus beta 1. It's an entangled state, right? But it still, you can see, has some kind of redundancy, right? We're repeating 0 three times and 1 three times. And that means that we have some hope, at least, of correcting a bit flip error. Yeah?
Sorry, that's a nice question. What if we make a lot of copies of this kind of states, and then from those we try to get more information about what alpha and beta is, and therefore...
Well, what do you mean? So what do you mean by a lot of copies? So we can't make multiple independent copies. Okay. All we can do is make bigger and bigger entangled states. That's the content of the no-cloning theorem. And that's why the no-cloning theorem is important, right? Because if you could make multiple copies, then you could, in fact, measure each of them and learn more than would be allowed by the uncertainty principle. Yeah, it is a very close tie, in fact. It's a no-cloning theorem and the uncertainty principle. The argument works both ways. Okay? So this solves problem one. We can make entangled states that still have some kind of redundancy without, you know, literally repeating the quantum state. Okay, so what about problem two? So this code should be able to correct one bit flip error, right? Certainly, if we weren't storing a superposition, if we were just storing a basis state, well, we know how to use this to correct a bit flip error, right? Then it's just the classical code. But what about on this quantum state? Now, if you think about it carefully, we don't really need to know whether when we have a state like this, whether when corrected it goes back to 0, 0, 0 or 1, 1, 1. The only thing we really need to know is where the error is. Okay? And once we know where the error is, we can flip it back, flip the bit back, and get back the original state. So if we can find some way of doing that without actually looking to see whether it's an encoded 0 or an encoded 1, then we won't collapse the superposition between them. Okay? So let me draw you a little circuit that does that. So here's our encoded state, alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1, maybe with an error on it. Okay, and we're going to add two ancilla qubits, starting in state 0. My circuit's wrong. Okay. And here's what we're going to do. So in the correct state, all three of these qubits should be the same, right? But if there's a bit flip, they won't all be the same. So that's what we want to see, whether they're all the same or whether one of them is different. So in particular, let's look at whether the first two are the same or different. Okay? If one of them has been flipped, then they'll be different. Otherwise, they'll be the same. So here's how we can do that. We can do a controlled knot from this first qubit to ancilla, and from the second qubit to the ancilla. Right? That way, if they're the same, either we get 0 or 2 bit flips on this ancilla, or if they're different, we get 1 bit flip. This is measuring the parity of these two qubits. Okay, and then we can measure it. Similarly, we can measure whether the second and third qubits are the same or different, doing the same thing. Yeah, let me just measure it over here. Okay, and then when we measure these two ancillas, we'll find out the answers to these questions. So this is called the error syndrome. And you can make a little table. Little table that tells you what error syndrome corresponds to what error. If it's 0, 0, if both of these are even parity, then that tells you the first and second bits are the same, and the second and third qubits are the same. That means all three are the same, so there's been no error. Right? And if it's 1, 0, well, what does that mean? That means the first two qubits are different, and the second and third qubits are the same. So that suggests it's the first qubit that's the odd one out, the first one that's been changed. So the error is on the first bit. Okay. Similarly, if it's 0, 1, the first and second are the same. The third one, second and third are different. So it's the third one that's been changed. And if it's 1, 1, then it's the second bit that's been changed. Okay. And so by measuring this, you find out where the error is. But you'll notice that nothing in this argument depended on actually what the original encoded state was, whether it was 0, 0, 0, or 1, 1, 1, or some superposition of the two. So we can process this error class, the error syndrome classically, and correct the error. And then the state we get back retains its quantum character. We haven't collapsed 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. So that's what we want to do. We want to measure the error, but not the encoded state. Okay? So that solves 2. Yeah?
Is it possible to use something like principle of deferred measurement to condition the correction quantumly rather than classically?
Absolutely. So this, So in order to process this error syndrome, we have to basically look up in this table. Okay. But there's nothing that says that you actually had to do that classically. Right? You could also have made a little quantum circuit, which says, well, if these two qubits are 0, 0, we'll do nothing up here. If it's 1, 0, we'll flip the first qubit. If it's 0, 1, we'll flip the third qubit. And if it's 1, 1, we'll flip the second qubit. Okay? So that's, you know, basically like 3 Toffoli gates, something like that. So that's fine. You can do that. And then you don't need to measure these at all, in fact. Just when you're done with them, you can just throw them out. It's frequently easier to talk about measuring them. And it has some practical differences when you actually get to fault-tolerant computation. Because then you have to worry, if you use quantum circuit here, you have to worry. So in fault tolerance, frequently we assume that the quantum gates have errors in them, but classical computation doesn't, because classical computers tend to be pretty reliable. And therefore, you know, doing a quantum circuit, you have to worry about errors in the gates there. But on the other hand, it saves you from having to do the measurement, which is, in some implementations, is very useful. Okay. So that was a side note. But the main point here is that, well, we've solved the first two problems. Okay? And in fact, we've made a very simple little quantum error correcting code. It protects a qubit against a single bit flip error. Okay? Okay. So let's move on from there. So let's approach this problem number three. Okay, so it's maybe a little too difficult to do both bit flip and phase errors at once. So let's start with just trying to protect a single qubit against a single phase error. Is that, you want to say something?
Yes.
Okay.
The second question.
Sure.
How would you implement the math that encodes a state? Would you just control not at all?
Yeah, so this one is very easy. So so we need three qubits, obviously. So we have the input qubit here. And then we can have two ancilla qubits that start at zero. And well, if this is zero, we want these to stay the same. If it's one, we want these to get flipped. So what is that? That's just two control knots. Okay?
Okay, I just wasn't sure if there's a subtlety I was missing or if that
was. No, this code really does have that simplest circuit.
Okay.
And in fact, well, okay. I won't go that far. These error correcting codes, quantum error correcting codes, tend to have relatively simple circuits. They just use control knots and Hadamard gates and a pi over 4 rotation, R pi over 4. All right, sorry. That's R pi over 2. Okay. So okay. So let's make a code to correct one bit flip error. Sorry, one phase error. And we'll ignore the possibility of a bit flip error for now. So we'll just say there's one, zero, one phase error, and we'll try to correct that. Well, so what is that? Well, in maybe more quantum language, a phase error is the sigma z operator. And compare that to sigma x, which is the bit flip. Okay? And if you remember what the Hadamard transform does, well, it transforms 0 into plus, right, 0 plus 1, and 1 into minus, 0 minus 1. And so the Hadamard actually has the property that it converts x into z and vice versa. Right? So the bit flip takes 0 into 1, but it leaves 0 plus 1 alone. And the phase flip takes plus into minus, but it leaves 0 alone. Similarly, the bit flip takes 0 minus 1 to gives an overall minus sign. And z takes 1 and gives an overall minus sign. Okay? So the Hadamard transform kind of converts between two bases that has the effect of switching the role of bit flip and phase flip errors. Okay? So what that tells us is that if we use the following code, where we encode 0 as 3 copies of plus and 1 as 3 copies of minus, then this code will correct one phase error. Of course, the superposition alpha 0 plus beta 1 will go to alpha plus 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 beta minus minus minus. Okay? Everyone see that, more or less? Okay? And the correction works just the same way. I mean, in fact, you can use the same circuit, just rotate everything by a Hadamard transform. The idea is you compare, are these two the same or different in the Hadamard rotated basis? And the second and third, the same or different in the Hadamard rotated basis. And that tells you the error syncrome that you can use to deduce where the error is. OK? OK. So then let's try to tackle problem three of correcting bit flip and phase errors simultaneously. OK? And to do that, we're going to have to add more qubits. We're going to kind of combine the bit flip error code with the phase error code. And so we're going to have a 9-qubit code. So that 9-qubit code is we're going to take 0 and encode it as 3 copies of 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. And 1 is going to get encoded as 3 copies of 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1. Okay? And of course, the superposition of alpha 0 plus beta 1 will be a superposition alpha times this plus beta times this. Okay? So how does this code work? Well, if there's a bit flip error, well, we can pick it up. We can identify it. By looking within each set of 3. Right? So we look at, you know, this set of 3, and all 3 qubits should be the same in the computational basis. And so we look to see if one of them is different. You know, compare the first and second here, compare the second and third here. And if one of them is different, well, then we know there's an error there. And so there's a bit flip error in particular, and so we can correct it. And similarly for the first 3 and the last 3. Okay? So if there's a bit flip error on any of these 9 qubits, we can find it. Okay? And if there's a phase error, well, what is a phase error going to do? So phase error, so for instance, on the 6th qubit, it'll change 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1 to 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1. And the minus, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1 will become 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Okay? But these phases won't change if there's only an error on the 6th qubit. So then these 3 signs, they're supposed to be the same. But if there's been error, a phase error, one of them will be different. So we can identify the phase error by comparing the 3 phases. Again, we don't actually want to measure each phase, because that would tell us whether we have an encoded 0 or encoded 1, or at least give us some information about that. But by seeing whether the 3 phases are the same or not, comparing them pairwise as before, then we can figure out where the error is and correct it. OK? And in fact, these steps are totally independent of each other. So if there's both a bit flip and a phase error, we can correct them both. Now, if there's 2 bit flip errors and they're on different sets of 3, we could correct that. But if 2 bit flip errors on a single set of 3, well, we won't be able to correct that, right? Because what will happen is, for instance, we'd have 1, 0, 1 plus 0, 1, 0. And we'll look at that and we'll say, oh, the second qubit is different. It must be the second qubit that was wrong. But that's incorrect. It was actually the first and third qubits that got flipped within the set of 3. And so we'll introduce a new error by doing the flip. Yeah?
Right.
So we have to be careful, of course. All we want to do is we want to measure what the error is. So we want to do a circuit like this, I'm not going to go through all the details for the scientific code, but I'll say a little bit more in a bit. We want to make a circuit like this that tells us what the error is. So in particular, we can apply exactly that circuit to each set of three to say, let's take the parity of the first two qubits. Is that even or odd? And that tells us whether they're the same or different, and similarly for the second and third. So this, it's a little more involved for the phases, because then you have to involve six qubits. And I'll get back to that in a minute. But again, you can write down a circuit that will just measure whether these two phases are the same or different without actually finding out which value each one of them is or anything else about the six qubits. OK? Yeah?
What happens if the answer is prone to error as well?
Oh, yeah. So that's certainly a problem. I really don't want to answer that, because it's unfortunately fairly complicated what you have to do to deal with that. But that's in the realm of fault-tolerant quantum computation. So in general, we're going to have to deal with the possibility that the ancillas have errors, that all the gates we're doing during error correction have errors, that the measurements, the process of measurements have errors. And you know, this is a big headache, certainly. So if we really want to protect the quantum computation against errors, we have to take this into account. And so we have to put something on top of this error correcting coding theory. But right now, I just want to talk about the communication version, where Alice and Bob have perfect quantum computers, and it's only errors come in the quantum channel when they're talking to each other. Yeah?
Is this optimal for correcting one phase split and one bit split? Because it seems like there's a lot of redundancy here that doesn't actually help us.
That's true. So there is a lot of redundancy. Like, as I mentioned, you can correct both a bit flip error on the first set of three and another bit flip error on the second set of three. And it's definitely not optimal. OK. Let me just leave the answer at that. You'll see a better code in the tutorial today. If I have time, I'll show you another better code. But this is not the best one. Okay, so there was another point I wanted to make, which is you can correct both the bit flip and the phase error. And in particular, if they're on the same qubit, well, you can correct that. Okay? So we can also correct one Y error, where Y is the third Pauli matrix minus II off diagonal, which is equal to I X times Z. So it's both a bit flip and the phase error. Okay. Like I said, it doesn't really matter that these are on the same qubit. But this is important because this is another example of a type of error that affects a single qubit. Okay. So we've already dealt with problem three. And in doing so, we got this Y error for free, correcting that. That's not always the case. I mean, you can write down codes that correct a bit flip error and phase errors, but don't correct Y errors. But in this particular case, we got it for free. So that's good. So we've solved three of our problems. But this fourth one seems kind of suspicious. Because in order to correct both bit flip and phase errors, we had to add extra qubits. Right? We had to go from 3 qubits to 9 qubits. As I said, that's not actually required. But we still had to increase beyond 3. And this set number 4 of problems, of other kinds of errors, is an infinite set of errors. So does that mean we're going to have to go to infinitely many qubits to correct that? That would be bad. We don't want to have to deal with infinitely many qubits. OK, so I'm going to leave you in suspense for a moment on that and say instead, well, let's just try doing something stupid. Which is, we're going to ignore the possibility of other kinds of errors. And we're just going to proceed as if X, Y, and Z were the only types of errors we had to worry about. OK, but suppose we do that, and there actually was a different kind of error. So for instance, let's take this R theta. Okay, suppose we actually had an R theta error on some qubit. Now, R theta, we can rewrite it. Remember, we can take out this factor of I theta over 2, e to the I theta over 2. So we have this This is a global phase, so I'll ignore it. So up to global phase is cosine theta over 2 times the identity plus I sine theta over 2 times z. Right? So you can expand this in terms of I and z, just as 2 by 2 matrices. OK. So suppose, like I said, we have r theta acting, say, on the ith qubit of this code, affecting our quantum state. Well, we can just write this expansion. So this is cosine theta over 2 I acting on psi plus I sine theta over 2 z acting on psi. OK? And suppose we apply this error correction procedure. We measure the syndrome just for the 9-qubit code, just pretending that we had only an x, y, or z error. Okay. Well, what would happen? Well, quantum mechanics is linear, right? So so this term, we know the error syndrome would say there's no error. Okay. So this here will be the syndrome. Syndrome register. This is before we've measured it. Okay? And this term, well, there's a z error on the ith qubit, I guess. And so our syndrome should tell us that there's a z error on that qubit. And I didn't leave quite enough space here. But by linearity, the state here will be have this amplitude for this and this amplitude for this. Right? So it'll be cosine theta over 2 times psi I plus I sine theta over 2 times zi, psi zi. So again, the same thing. OK? And now let's measure the syncrome bits. OK, well, what happens then? Well, the syncrome bits have different values for these two cases. These are orthogonal states. So this is shorthand for some string of bits that corresponds to the syncrome that gives that for zi. And this is, well, probably all zeros string, which is the syncrome that corresponds to the identity. OK? And so when we measure the syncrome bits, we're going to collapse this register. And actually, it's entangled with the rest of the computation. So what happens is, with probability cosine squared theta over 2, we get this state. And with probability sine squared theta over 2, we get this state. Zi acting on psi, and the syncrome says Zi. OK? So look at what's happened. When we did this measurement, the state now is either no error, or it has a z error on it, even though we started with this continuous rotation. OK? So by pretending that there was only an x, y, or z error, and acting, doing the error correction in this way, we made it actually true that there was only an x, y, or z error. Kind of a triumph of wishful thinking. What's happened here is that by measuring the error, we collapsed the error. Right? The error started as a superposition of different kinds of errors. And we tried to figure out what that error was and measured it, and therefore collapsed it into one of our basis errors. And so that's really what's going on here. So I, x, y, and z, they form a basis for all 2 by 2 matrices. Right? Any 2 by 2 matrix can be written as a sum of I, x, y, and z. And therefore, you can expand any error this way. And by linearity, the code will act as a sum of something that has no error. something that has an x error, something that has a y error, and something that has a z error. Of course, as in this case, some of those amplitudes might be zero. But the point is that then by measuring the error in this xyz basis, ixyz basis, we can collapse it to one of those and get it to something that we know how to deal with already with a nine-qubit code. So the upshot, this is applies to the nine-qubit code, but it's really a very general theorem. So any quantum error-correcting code that corrects I, X, Y, or Z single-qubit errors also corrects any single-qubit error. Okay, so what I've shown you so far only applies directly to some unknown unitary operation. So in this case, rotation by some unknown angle. But you can easily extend it to apply to more general CPTP maps on a single qubit. Why is that? Well, you remember the Krauss representation of a CPTP map was taking the density matrix to the sum over k, ak rho, ak dagger. Okay, so if this is part of a pure state, if this is a pure state, basically, this is going to ak psi, psi, ak dagger. So effectively, we're saying that the state psi goes to ak psi with some probability. And it's a little more subtle than that because this probability actually depends on the initial state. But the point is then AK, well, it's not unitary, but it's still a 2x2 matrix if it's acting only on one qubit. So we can expand it as a sum of I, X, Y, and Z. And then the same argument applies. Right? When we measure the error, we collapse it, and it actually becomes one of I, X, Y, or Z. So you can also extend this theorem so that what I said was for single-qubit errors, but you can apply the same thing to many-qubit errors. Right? Tensor products of I, X, Y, and Z on T qubits span the space of 2 to the T by 2 to the T matrices. So any t qubit error can be written as a sum of x, I, x, y, and z acting on t qubits. Right? It's not x on all t qubits or y on all t qubits. It could be a mix, right? It could be I tensor x, tensor y, tensor x, tensor z, something like that. But that means that we can generalize this theorem. So any t qubit error, if it corrects I, x, y, and z t qubit errors, then it corrects any T qubit error. Okay? So this is the thing that, well, this solves problem 4 and shows us that we really have a quantum error correcting code. And so this 9-qubit code is a quantum error correcting code that corrects any single qubit error. Yeah?
A two-qubit error with t greater than 1 is an error that can entangle to a qubit.
Yeah, so I mean, a general t-qubit error can do anything. So what it can do is it can take, you know, so usually with these error correcting codes, we allow it to act on any set of t-qubits. So it can take any set of t-qubits and do whatever it wants to, and do the general, completely positive trace preserving map. So it can do an entangling thing. It can, you know, throw them all out and replace them with something else, whatever it wants.
So suppose you have like a t qubit error that just like does a bit flip independently on like t different bits.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right to think of that as a combination of one qubit errors, or because
that one you can think of as a combination of one qubit errors. It's an x. I mean x tensor x tensor x tensor x. Right. Right? So it could be a sequence of one qubit error. Now remember that just because a code can correct a one qubit error doesn't mean it can correct two separate one-qubit errors.
Right.
Right? Like the repetition code, if you flip two bits separately before you start doing correction, that will get you in trouble. So that's a two-qubit error, but it's a kind of a simple one. And that's really the content of the theorem. It says that it's enough to deal with those simple types of errors in order to correct every error. Okay. So in the remaining time, let me get a little bit more into the more advanced formalism of quantum error correcting codes, and tell you how you can start to think about generating better codes. Okay, so let's go back to this 9-qubit code again. And let's write down the things we need to measure to figure out the error syndrome. So first of all, we wanted to measure whether the first two qubits were the same or different, right? That's what we did with the circuit I just erased. And to do that, we measured the parity, right? We did control knots. But we can phrase that in a more quantum language and write some operator that has an eigenvalue that's the thing that we're trying to measure. Okay, so in particular, measuring the parity of two qubits that's the same as measuring the eigenvalue of Z tensor Z. Do you see that? Because Z tensor Z, well, it's 1 minus 1 tensor 1 minus 1. So if it's 0, 0, we get 2 plus 1s for the eigenvalue. If it's 1, 1, we get 2 minus 1s, which is a plus 1 eigenvalue again. But if they're different, we get a plus 1 and a minus 1. So the eigenvalue is minus 1. Okay. So the eigenvalue of ZZ tells us whether the two qubits are the same or different in the computational basis. So that's the first set of things we have to measure. We have to measure ZZ for the first two qubits to see if they're the same or different, and for the second and third qubit. So for 9-qubit code, we need these eigenvalues. Okay, so that's for the first three qubits. And you can put in the eyes yourself, but I'll save myself writing and make it easier to read by leaving them out. Okay, and then for the next set of three, we have to do the same thing. We want to measure whether the fourth and fifth qubits are the same or different, and whether the fifth and sixth qubits are the same or different. And similarly for the seventh, eighth, and ninth. Okay, so these are the six things we measure to figure out where the bit, any single bit flip error is, or one for each set of three. Okay, everyone got that? Now, what about the phase flip errors? Right, for that, we want to measure whether the phases are the same or different. So I said I'd come back to that, and now I'm doing it. So how do we do that? Well, to measure whether we have a plus or minus here, we should measure XXX, right? Because XXX will take 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1 and switch them. So the plus, 0, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, 1, will stay invariant, will have plus 1 eigenvalue. But 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 1, well, it'll get an overall minus sign. So it has minus 1 eigenvalue. Of course, we don't want to measure that. We don't want to measure X tensor, X tensor, X, because we don't want to measure the value of this phase. We just want to measure whether it's the same or different as this phase. So if we measure XXX on the on the first three and also on the second three, so the tensor product of six x's, well, that'll give us plus 1 when these phases are the same, because it'll be plus 1 squared or minus 1 squared, and minus 1 if they're different. So that's what we want to get. We want to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and qubits 4 through 9. OK? So here's the 8 things we have to measure to tell us the error syndrome for this 9-qubit code. So the valid 9-qubit code words all have eigenvalue plus 1 for these 8 operators. And there's other things for which the code always has eigenvalue plus 1. But these are kind of the independent ones, the ones that tell us the most. And by measuring these things, then we can measure the error syndrome and figure out what the error is. OK, running out of time here. So it's maybe starting to become obvious from, you know, from this list of things and from this theorem and from, you know, maybe everything else I've done today that x, y, and z are playing a very important role in the theory of quantum error correction. So let me define the Pauli group. And we'll call it, I guess, Pn. Is the group generated by by tensor products of I, x, y, and z acting on n qubits. Okay? So these operators are all members of the Pauli group. The Pauli group actually consists of 4 to the n plus 1 elements, because there's an overall phase. X, y, and z all anti-commute with each other, right? So you can get a minus 1 there. And there's this factor of I that unfortunately shows up as well. So you have tensor products of I, x, y, and z on each n of qubits, so there's 4 to the n of those. Then you can have an overall phase of plus or minus 1, plus or minus I. Yeah?
Is there a relation to Clifford
algebra? Probably. I mean, there is. It's not something that, as far as I know, has been totally pursued. The thing is that here we're working really just with the group structure and not a full algebra structure. There's something else that's called the Clifford group, which was based on the feeling that there could be a connection, but it's probably not as useful as the name as it might be. Anyway. So this is the Pauli group, and then I want to define a couple of just really one error correcting concept. So the stabilizer of a quantum error correcting code is defined as the set of Paulis. Called M, such that all the code words have eigenvalue plus 1. Okay? So not every code is this a sensible thing to do, but for a lot of the most interesting codes it is. And the 9-qubit code is an example, right? And so the stabilizer for the 9-qubit code is generated by these 8 operators.
Hmm?
Oh, sorry. So this is set of M in the poly group. So M is some operator, but it has to be of this form. Okay? And actually, the stabilizer is a very, very useful thing to look at, to the extent that frequently we choose S and then define a quantum error correcting code around it. Particularly, we let the code space be the static vector psi, such that m psi is equal to psi for all m in S. Okay, and so you can define the non-qubit code this way if you wanted. You could take these generators, use them to define a stabilizer, and then the non-qubit code becomes the code. Well, those basis vectors span this subspace. Okay. So we can't do this for an arbitrary S. There's a few conditions we have to satisfy. So let me just quickly say those, and then maybe that'll call it a day. Okay, so in particular, S is a group, right? So if M is in S and N is in S, well, then that means that M N psi, well, N psi is equal to psi, so this is equal to M psi, and M psi is equal to psi, and this is true for all psi in the code. Okay, so that means mn psi is equal to psi for all psi in the code. So mn is in the stabilizer. So the stabilizer is closed under multiplication. That makes it a group. For the polys, we don't have to check inverses because basically these things are either self-inverse or in the case of if you have a factor of I out front, then it's minus I. Okay. So S is a group. Let's see, we know that minus 1, minus the identity, is not in S, right? Because, well, we want it to be the set of things for which have plus 1 eigenvalues for the code words. And minus 1 doesn't have any plus 1 eigenvalues. So condition 1, condition. And then the third condition, S is actually an abelian group. Why is that? Well, suppose M and N are in S. Well, that says that MN psi is equal to psi. But also it means that NM psi is equal to psi. So if you take the difference of these, that means the commutator MN minus NM annihilates psi. Okay, which doesn't inherently, for arbitrary M and N, wouldn't mean that they have to commute. It just means that this commutator has some zero eigenvalues. But the polys are very special operators. In fact, they either commute or they anti-commute. And if they anti-commute, then this commutator is going to be proportional to another poly. So in the case of polys, so that implies that M and N commute. And that means it's an abelian group, right? Commutative group. Okay. So it turns out you can kind of understand this intuitively, right? We want to find the stabilizer, which is something that has plus one eigenvectors that make up the code space, right? So in order to have for these different operators in the stabilizer to have simultaneous eigenvectors, well, we should have them being commutative operators. Okay. So that's the idea here. So if we satisfy all three of these conditions, then we have a valid stabilizer, and we can use that trick to define the code. Now, I haven't quite told you why this is a good idea. So maybe I'll get to that tomorrow, tell you kind of the basic properties of the code. You won't be able to do quite all of the tutorial today, but maybe you can look at it tomorrow, you know, if you have some extra time. Or maybe we'll see what we want to do with that. It depends how much you get through today, I guess. But you should be able to at least do a lot of this part. Yeah? There's a subgroup that's isomorphic to Z2, right? Of the stabilizer or of polygroup?
Oh, right.
But either one has Z2 subgroups. Like, so for the non-qubit code, if you look at the subgroup generated by Z tensor Z, well, that's square to the identity, so that's a Z2 subgroup.
Sorry.
Yeah?
From the definition of
the
series,
okay.
It seems you have just one element in there.
It's a set of all things that are plus one eigenvectors for everything in the stabilizer. So it's, in general, you don't know how many there's going to be. It turns out that you can get this just from the number of generators.
So I'm looking at the definition of m psi is equal to psi. I can think m psi is equal to psi and n psi is equal to psi. Therefore, m minus n is equal to 0. Means that n is equal to
0. No, that's not right. So that's an example where this type of argument you have to be careful of. Okay, so for instance, the identity, that's 1, 1, and z, that's 1 minus 1. Okay, but both of these certainly have simultaneous plus 1 eigenvector of 0. Right, well, how do you resolve that? Well, the identity minus z, that's equal to 1, so it has a 0 eigenvalue. But this is equal to 2. Okay, so this is a case where you subtract two polys, and you get something that has a 0 eigenvalue, so it annihilates 0. That's OK. But it also has a non-zero eigenvalue. And we just don't see that because we're only looking at it for the code words in some subspace. So it really does require that there be a spectral property here, that this commutator has no zero eigenvalues unless it's equal to 0. Okay, so this only holds for the polys when you do this argument. Okay, so basically what you can check is if you take the commutator of any two of these things, either you get 0 or tensor products of these things. Either you get 0, or you get something that has no 0 eigenvalues. So it's not that hard to check that. I won't go through it because we're out of time. But that's the property that you need in order to do this last step. And it's not true if you just subtract.